was conscious that she might well be out of work very soon. She'd hoped for a hot pot, or a pie, or something warm and filling. In fact, if she was totally honest, she'd fantasized about a friendly farmer's wife and home-baked apple pie and cream, then realized that she was thinking about an Enid Blyton novel, not a real place she was actually visiting.
Yes, please, she said.
And the man disappeared through the back into what looked like a tiny kitchen space, while Nina stared hard at her phone as if that might make it work, and wondered if she could just take her book out again. One of the men asked her a question, which she didn't quite understand, but guessed to be, "What are you doing up here?" And she mentioned that she'd come to look at a van. At this, they both burst out laughing and ushered her outside. In the little town square, the fading light picking out the names on the war memorial, McKendra, McGee, McInglis. They led her across the cobbles to a side street completely blocked by the van from the advert. Nina stared at it. It was pretty grubby, but she could see that underneath the dirt, and some rust on the front grill, was the lovely curved roof and friendly nose that had so attracted her in the advert. The main thing that struck her, though, was that it was far, far larger than she'd expected. Worryingly large, in fact. Could she really handle it? Seeing the van in the flesh, as it were, rather than in a fantasy or just as an idea, made her suddenly anxious. Her idea of a future doing something where she wasn't protected by a salary and sick pay and holiday pay, and someone else doing all the planning and organisation, if it was to start anywhere, it would start in this little grey stone square, with the last weak rays of evening sunshine coming over the hills, the smell of sharp pine and sweet gorse in her nostrils, a chill wind blowing down the valley, and the air so clear she could see for miles.
"Finally getting rid of that eyesore," said one of the men, laughing, as the other one sized her up. Nina's ear was beginning to get attuned to their way of speaking. "You're no really going to buy Findhorn's van," said the other in disbelief. "That thing's been rusting out there since the year dot." "Are you sure you can handle it, a wee thing like you?" said the first man, unfortunately echoing exactly what Nina had been thinking herself. The van had looked pretty normal in the photograph, but here it seemed absolutely gigantic, old-fashioned, and terrifying. "What are you going to do with it?" said the older man, wonderingly.
Not sure," said Nina, unwilling to give herself away in case she got committed. Now that she'd actually made her way here, everything felt so terribly real. The men exchanged glances.
"Well, Willie'll be in soon enough."
They headed back to the pub, Nina shooting anxious glances behind her. It was truly, terribly big. Doubt gripped her. After all, this was completely out of character. She'd seen it now. It wasn't appropriate. She'd go back and write a CV like Griffin's, and promise Kathy Neeson that she'd do anything, sacrifice anything, perform motivational handstands if she could just hold on to her job. Yes, that was what she'd do. And she could go back to working all day and reading all evening, and occasionally going for drinks with Sarinda, because her life wasn't bad, was it? It was absolutely fine. It was okay. Whereas doing something like this, nobody would believe it. It would be a crazy, huge mistake, and she'd just quietly go home, and never mention it again, and nobody would even notice. The landlord looked up with a broad grin when she re-entered.
"Ah, there you are,"
he said, pushing across a loaded plate. There was a huge doorstop sandwich on fresh white bread with a thick, crackling crust. In between were slathers of butter and some ripe, crumbly local cheese Nina had never tasted before, smothered in homemade pickle, with a crisp pickled onion on the side. She smiled to see it. She really was starving, and Alistair's face was friendly and kind. Suddenly, together with the smooth beer, the meal made perfect sense, and she consumed it all, sitting at the bar, her book propped in front of her. Alistair beamed approvingly.
"I like a girl who enjoys her food," he said. "That's Archie's, you know. got some goats up on the moor.
Well, it's lovely, said Nina appreciatively.
The door creaked open behind her, and she turned around. Another old man, heavy-set, with deep wrinkles around his blue eyes, and an old hat, entered the bar. He sounded gruff.
"Has that bus been through?" he said.
"Aye, Woolly," said one of the other men.
"Here's your latest van buyer."
Woolly looked at Nina, and his cheery face turned suddenly grave.
"Yous are having me on," he said to his jubilant companions.
"Hello," said Nina nervously. "Are you Mr. Findhorn?"
"Mm," said Woolly. "Aye."
"I answered your ad."
"I know. I didn't realise you were a young lass, though."
Nina bit her lip crossly.
"Well, I'm a young lass with a driver's licence," she said.
"Aye, I'm sure, but..."
His brow furrowed.
"I'm not. I mean, I was expecting someone a bit older, like. Maybe from a trucking company."
"How do you know I'm not from a trucking company?"
There was a pause in the quiet bar. On the other side, underneath the taps, there was a kind of squirming, groaning noise, and Nina realised there must be a dog back there. Woolly thought it over.
"Are you from a trucking company?" he said finally.
"No," said Nina. "I'm a librarian."
The two old men cackled like Statler and Waldorf, until Nina had to give them her special silence-in-the-library look. She was starting to lose patience. 10 minutes ago she'd been all ready to call it off and go home. Now she wanted to show this stupid man she was perfectly capable of whatever he didn't think she was capable of.
"Is this van for sale or not?" she said loudly.
Woolly took his hat off and nodded at Alastair, who poured him a pint of something called 80 shilling.
"Aye," he said in a resigned voice. "I can let ye have a test drive in the morning."
Nina felt suddenly exhausted as Alastair showed her up to a small, basic, but very clean and tidy whitewashed room with bare floorboards. It looked out over the back of the pub, away from the village, and across the great, dipping hills beyond, the sun only now making its way below the horizon. There were loads of birds chattering around the window, but apart from that, there was absolutely no noise. A distant car, maybe, but no traffic, no sirens, no bin lorries or people shouting out on the street, or neighbours having a party. She sniffed the air. It was so fresh and clean it made her head spin. She swallowed a glass of tap water. It was freezing cold and utterly refreshing. She had thought she would lie awake in the comfortable white linened bed and draw up a list of pros and cons and things that might help her decide what she should do next. Instead, with the bird still singing outside the window, she was fast asleep by the time her head hit the pillow.
"What kind of sausage do you want?"
Nina shrugged. She didn't know how many kinds of sausages they had.
"Whichever's best."
The landlord smiled.
"Okay, then. We'll give you some lawn sausage off Woolly's pegs. That'll be fitting."
Nina had slept like the dead until something had woken her like an alarm clock at 7 a.m. Peering blearily out of the little dormer window, she had realised it appeared to be a rooster. She had dressed and gone downstairs, ready to try out the van for appearance's sake before hitting the bus again and forgetting all about her little Scottish adventure. There must be bookshops and places that needed staff. Maybe she'd start there. The money wouldn't be as good as she'd been on, but she had never met a bookseller she didn't like, and as long as she could still be around books, still be close by, surely that would be enough. Breakfast, when it arrived, was a serious affair, a meal to be treated with respect. She sat at the polished table by the window, where she could see all the comings and goings of the village, schoolchildren running along in a free and easy manner in their bright red jumpers, tractors pulling trailers full of mysterious machinery, horses out for their morning exercise, and plenty of Land Rovers off and about their business. Alastair set down a huge bowl of porridge with honey and thick, fresh cream, still slightly warm. This was followed by a plate of lawn sausage, which turned out to be square and crispy and utterly delicious.
golden-yolked eggs that tasted better than any Nina had ever had. She assumed they came courtesy of the chickens out the back. Crispy bacon, black pudding, and triangular things that she thought were toast, but turned out to be some kind of thin potato cake. After just a sandwich for supper, she realized she was ravenous, and polished off the entire thing. It was completely and utterly delicious.
"Get that down, you," said the landlord happily, refilling her coffee cup. "Wooly'll be busy up the farm till 11, so there's no rush."
"This is amazing," said Nina happily.
"You look like you could do with a feed," said Alistair. "A feed and a bit of fresh air."
Nina had been told regularly since she was a child that she needed more fresh air, at which she would take her book and clamber up the apple tree at the bottom of their tatty garden, away from the car her father was always tinkering with, but had never driven in all the years of her childhood. She wondered what had happened to it, and hide there, braced against the trunk, her feet swinging, burying herself in Enid Blyton or Roald Dahl until she was allowed back inside again. It was a good place to be, because she had learned, when people were looking for you, they never looked up, which meant that her two brothers couldn't track her down to either rope her into one of their stupid war games, or, when she refused, tease her for liking books so much, and sometimes grab whatever she was reading and throw it to each other over her head until she cried. So she simply smiled politely at Alistair. Nina really loved wet and cold winter days. She liked to sit with her back to the radiator, listening to the rain hurl itself against the window panes as if it could breach them. She liked knowing she had nothing to do that afternoon, that there was bread to toast and cream cheese to spread, and gentle music playing, and she could curl up, cosy and warm, and lose herself in Victorian London, or a zombie-laden future, or wherever else she felt like. For most of her life, the outdoors had simply been something to shelter from whilst she got on with her reading. Now she stood at the threshold of the pub door. The air outside was bracing, the sun bright, the breeze cold and fresh. She took a deep breath. Then she did, for Nina, a very unusual thing. "Can I just leave this here?" she said to the landlord, and when he nodded, she placed the huge hardback down on top of the table. "I'll be back soon," she said as he waved her away, and she stepped outside, book free for the first time in a very long time. Chapter 5. It was another splendid day outside, not at all what Nina had been expecting. It looked like the sky had been freshly laundered, a bright TV studio blue with fluffy clouds passing across. It was ridiculous, she mused, how little time she spent in the countryside, considering how much Britain had of it. There was always concrete under her feet. She rarely stepped off the pavement, and the sky was hemmed in by street lamps and the high-rises that were popping up in Birmingham city centre at the rate of about one a week, it felt like. She looked around. Sunlight rippled through the trees, puddled down the furrows of the fields. Across the road were great lakes of shimmering yellow rape. A tractor happily trundled across a field with birds flying in front of it, like something out of an old ladybird book about life on a farm. Reflecting the clouds above, a little cohort of lambs were charging around, hopping up and down, and nipping at one another's tails in a field so green it looked technicolor. Nina watched them, unable to stop herself smiling. This was so unlike her. She took a selfie of herself with the lambs behind her and sent it to Griffin and Sarinda. Her housemate immediately replied, inquiring whether she'd been kidnapped by aliens and did she need help. 2 seconds later, Griffin texted back, asking if she knew what interfacing methodologies in library connectivity was, but she ignored that and tried to damp down the anxiety it sparked in her. After exploring the village, she noticed there was no library. She walked on up a hill track from where she could see the sea, closer than she'd expected, with a little rocky cove one could clamber down to. She shook her head. It was paradise, this place. Where was everyone? Why were they all crammed into the same corner of England, honking at each other in traffic jams, breathing each other's fumes and food smells, and squeezing in and out of pubs and clubs. She saw a huge black rain cloud building up in the far distance. It couldn't just be that, could it? Apart from the distant putt of the tractor, she could hear nothing at all. She felt suddenly as if she hadn't been breathing, not properly, for a long time. It was as if her entire body was exhaling. Standing on top of the hill, she surveyed the landscape. She could see for miles. There were several other villages dotted about, all looking quite similar, in ancient soft grey stone and slate. And in front of her, the valley unfolded, green and yellow and brown, rolling onwards all the way down to the white-crested sea. It was a most peculiar feeling. Nina breathed in suddenly, all the way in, and felt her shoulders uncurl, as if they'd been jammed up around her ears. Maybe they had been, she thought. After all, it had been a year since they'd first heard rumours about the library. 7 months before they knew it was the subject of a consultation paper, 2 months since they knew it was definitely happening, and 3 weeks since she'd known for certain she was out of a job if she didn't pass the interview. But she'd been living with that uncertainty, that inability to plan the next stage of her life, for much longer than that. She stared into the distance and tried to think, honestly and properly, about her life. Up here, where it was clearer, and she could breathe, and she wasn't surrounded by a million people in a tearing hurry, dashing or grabbing or shouting or achieving things in their lives that they plastered all over Facebook and Instagram, making you feel inadequate. Some people buried their fears in food, she knew, and some in booze, and some in planning elaborate engagements and weddings and other life events that took up every spare moment of their time, in case unpleasant thoughts intruded. But for Nina, whenever reality, or the grimmer side of reality, threatened to invade, she always turned to a book. Books had been her solace when she was sad, her friends when she was lonely. They had mended her heart when it was broken, and encouraged her to hope when she was down. Yet much as she disputed the fact, it was time to admit that books were not real life. She'd managed to hold reality at bay for the best part of 30 years, but now it was approaching at an incredibly speedy rate, and she was absolutely going to have to do something, anything, about it. That was what Sarinda had said when Nina had asked her honestly what she thought about the van idea. "Just do something. You might make a mistake, then you can fix it, but if you do nothing, you can't fix anything, and your life might turn out full of regrets." Suddenly, that seemed to make sense. Suddenly, everything she'd thought on the way up, "I can't do this, I'm not assertive enough, I couldn't possibly run my own business, I won't be any good at it, I can't drive that van, I can't make this happen, I have to hold on to my safe job," sounded feeble and pathetic. Here, looking down on the valley, at the tiny villages full of people getting on with their own lives and their own way, unbothered by trends or fashions or the pace of the city, or some kind of odd concept of getting ahead, Nina had the oddest sense of things she had ever experienced. She'd been raised in a city, educated in a city, had worked and lived in that world. Yet somehow, deep within herself, she felt that she had come home. A cloud passed over the sun, and Nina shivered. It turned cold quickly here, and she headed back down the hill towards the pub, lost in thought. The 2 old men who'd been there yesterday were propped up against the bar again. One of them was holding her book, and looked to be deeply into it already. "Are you enjoying that?" she asked with a smile. It was an Arctic thriller, set at the very ends of the earth, just one man against the elements, the polar bears, and a mysterious presence beyond the ice. The man glanced up guiltily. "Oh, sorry, lass," he said. "I just picked it up to have a look at it, and it kind of sucked me in." "It's great," said Nina, adding, "I'll leave it for you after I'm done with it, if you like."
"Oh, no, lass, don't be silly. Big, expensive book like this."
His watery eyes looked sad suddenly.
"We used to have a library and a bookshop, you know. Both gone now.
His friend nodded.
Used to be a nice wee trip out, that. If you wanted to go to the big library, get the bus, go choose a book, have a cup of tea.
The two men looked at one another.
Ah, well, you know, things change, Hugh. They do, Edwin. They do.
The double doors of the old pub creaked open, and Wooly stood there, squinting in the darkness of the bar. He glanced over to where Nina was standing, then looked around, just in case there was anyone else there he hadn't noticed the first time, putting off the moment when he was actually going to have to interact with her. Eventually, his eyes came back to settle on her, and his face took on a look of disappointment.
"Hi, Wooly," said Alistair,
already setting a foaming pint of brown ale on top of the counter.
"How's it going this morning?"
Wooly looked downcast as he headed towards the bar to sit down.
"Aye, so," he began. "The young lady's ready for a test drive," announced the landlord cheerily. "She's only a little thing, but—" "Aye, so,"
Wooly said again. The room fell silent.
"Oh,"
said Wooly finally, taking off a very battered-looking hat.
"Only this time I really thought I'd sold her. I swear to God."
Hello, said Nina, stepping forward. I'm Nina, remember? Here to look at your van?
Aye, so, said Wooly. But it's a big van, you ken.
He took a long sup of his pint.
I really thought we'd got it sold this time, he repeated.
He shook his head.
I don't understand why nobody wants it.
I might want it, said Nina impatiently.
It's not really a wee lassie's van, said Wooly.
Well, I'm not really a wee lassie, whatever that is, said Nina. I'm perfectly capable of driving that van, and I've come all this way to try it out.
Edwin and Hugh were snickering now. Nina didn't think they'd had such a spectacle round the village in years.
It's a big van, said Wooly again.
Nina sighed in exasperation.
Can I have the keys, please? I did email you about this.
Yes, but I had no idea you were a lassie.
My name is Nina.
Yeah, but that's a foreign name, isn't it? I mean, it could be.
Wooly, said Alistair, his normally twinkly face suddenly turning stern. This lassie's come a long way to see your van. You've put it up for sale. I don't see what the problem is.
I don't want her crashing it, is the problem, said Wooly. She dies, and I have even more problems than I have now, which is a lot.
I'm not going to crash it, said Nina.
How many vans have you driven?
Well, not many, but...
What do you drive now?
A mini metro.
Wooly harumphed.
Wooly? If you don't stop being rude to the lady, you're not getting a pint. Oh, come on, man. I've been up for 7 hours.
The landlord held the beer up threateningly. Wooly scowled and rifled in his pockets, which were deep and many. Finally, he took out a large set of keys and threw them on a nearby table.
I'll need security,
he scowled. Nina took out her passport.
Can I leave this with you?
He frowned.
You don't actually need one of those to get into Scotland. Yet.
The men at the bar cackled appreciatively. Nina was desperate to throw her hands up in surrender. She hated conflict in any form. But she couldn't, wouldn't forget how she'd felt that morning. She would be as kick-ass as Katniss Everdeen, as uncompromising as Elizabeth Bennet, as brave as Hero. She told herself she only needed to drive it across the square. Then she could leave. Turn around. Go home. Hope for the best at the library. Her bravado had been shaken by this man, but she wasn't entirely deterred. She picked up the keys.
I'll be back shortly, she said.
She stepped out of the pub and into the square. She felt wobbly inside. She was used to dealing with the occasional rowdy child, or people unhappy that she was charging them for late returns, but those weren't personal attacks. This was different. It was someone making a very clear point that she was annoying them. The men had followed her outside the pub, and she could feel their eyes on her. Where were all the women around these parts? She wondered as she crossed the cobbles and moved over to the side street where the big white behemoth was parked. She paused for a moment and looked at its old-fashioned headlamps. "Listen, Van," she said, "I don't really know what I'm doing here, but neither do you, right? You've been abandoned on this street for years. You're lonely. So you help me, and I'll help you, okay?" She unlocked the door, which was a start at least. The next thing was getting into the cab. There were a couple of steps, but even they were high. She pulled her skirt above her knees and hoisted herself up. It wasn't graceful, but it was effective. She wobbled a little opening the door and thought for a second she was going to fall off the step, but she didn't. And in a moment, she was sitting in a big, cracked leather seat patched with gaffer tape. The inside of the cab smelled, not unpleasantly, of faded straw and distant grass. Nina turned round. It seemed huge to her, but she reminded herself yet again that it wasn't a lorry. She didn't need an HGV license. Anyone could drive this thing. People did it all the time. It felt a lot like a bus, though, and it was parked in such a very narrow street, the little stone cottages either side of her almost touching the vehicle. She swallowed, then turned back again and inspected the controls. It looked like a normal car, except everything was much further away. She fumbled under the seat for the release and moved a little closer to the huge steering wheel. The gear stick, too, was massive and unwieldy. There wasn't a rear-view mirror, and the side mirrors just scared her sick. She sat there for a moment in silence. Then she glanced towards the pub, where the men were standing staring at her, and felt a new wellspring of iron in her heart. Leaning forward, adjusting the mirrors, and making sure at least 5 times that she was in neutral, she put the key in the ignition and turned it. The noise it made was a huge growl, an awful lot louder than the mini metro, an awful lot louder than anything. Nina saw a flock of birds rise up over the houses and spiral into the air. Holding her breath and saying a silent prayer, she moved into first, put her foot very carefully on the accelerator, and pushed down the heavy handbrake. The van jumped forward and immediately stalled and stuttered to a halt. Nina thought she saw the men laughing outside the pub and narrowed her eyes. She turned the key back and tried again. This time, it moved smoothly into gear, and she took off into the square, bouncing on the cobbles. Not knowing exactly where she was going, she turned left down the first wide street she came to, and within moments found herself rumbling up the hill towards the moors. The van was a lot nippier than it had first appeared. Nina changed down into second and held on for the ride. She'd never driven so high up before. She could see right out to sea over the crest of the hill. There were great tankers arriving, from the Netherlands and Scandinavia and China, she imagined, bringing in toys and furniture and paper, and taking oil and whiskey back the other way. A huge red truck drove past her and honked loudly. Nina jumped in her seat before realizing it was just a friendly greeting between trucks. As she rounded an unusually sharp bend, a tiny zippy sports car nipped in front of her and raced off, which also gave her a fright. Shaken, she parked up in the first lay-by she came to and gripped the steering wheel tightly. She noticed that her hands were shaking. She wound down the window and gulped in several breaths of bracing fresh air until she felt a little better. Then she jumped out of the cab, scrambled down to the ground, and took a proper look around. The problem was, Nina thought, kicking the tyres, she didn't really know enough about vans to know if this one was any good. She wasn't even sure you were meant to kick the tyres, although there was a certain satisfaction to it, especially when the tyres were as big as these ones. They didn't seem bald, though, and she managed to open the bonnet, even though she didn't know what she was looking for. Nothing was rusty, and there was oil in it. Even she could check oil. Inside, the back needed a bit of a clean-up, mostly straw removed, but that was fine. It was easy to see how the shelving would go in, and how the little seating area could work at the back, and the side door opened perfectly, with the set of steps unfolding smoothly. In fact, as Nina carried on with her inspection, she started to get excited again. Suddenly, she could see it all in her mind's eye, parking up somewhere like this beautiful lay-by. Well, maybe not a lay-by. Somewhere in town where people could get to her. Painting the insides colourfully, filling the shelves with the very best of everything she knew, helping to match people to the book that would change their life, or make them fall in love, or get over a love affair gone wrong. And for the children, she could show them where to dive into a crocodile-infested river, or fly through the stars, or open the door of a wardrobe. She sat, gazing at her fantasy, imagining it bustling and filled with life, and people coming up to her saying, "Nina, thank goodness you're here. I need a book that will save my life." She slammed the door shut excitedly. Yes, she could do it. She thought back to how she'd felt that morning. She would show that old guy in the pub. She would buy this blooming van and make a success of it, and everything would be absolutely fine. She was so excited that she only stalled 4 times on the way back to the village, got lost once, and spooked a horse, which made the posh-sounding woman riding it curse her in an extremely non-posh fashion that rang in her ears all the way back down to Kirinfeef, and she was pretty sure would traumatise the horse far more than the van would have done.
"I've changed my mind," said Willie when she parked up carefully outside the pub. "It's not for sale."
Nina stared at him, aghast.
"But I managed to reverse it and everything."
This wasn't strictly true, but she'd looked at where the reverse lever would go and reckoned she could handle it, as long as nobody was yelling horse abuse at her.
"I don't want to sell it."
"That's just sexist."
"It's my van, and I don't care."
Wooly turned and looked to stomp off out of the pub.
"Please," said Nina. "I have plans for it, and there aren't any others I can find for sale that are just what I need. And I've come all this way, and I'm really going to look after it."
Wooly turned round, and Nina's heart leapt briefly.
"No,"
he said, and he let the door bang behind him on the way out. Chapter 6 Nina snuck a glance at Kathy Neeson, who was sitting on the end of the interview panel with her arms folded and her face giving absolutely nothing away. Would it really hurt her to smile? Nina thought. She was doing her best, in her new black tights she'd splurged on, trying to make her hands look calm and relaxed, rather than squirming them on her lap. Just a little glimmer of recognition. Although she hadn't studied that hard for the interview, nobody knew the ins and outs of the books better than she, the ordering and filing systems, and everything that went into making the library work properly. She couldn't know that Kathy Neeson had 46 interviews to sit in on this week, for only 2 jobs, both of which she was under instruction to give to lively young people who could shout a lot, looked nice in the literature, and would work for next to nothing. And although she'd argued about it at the top level till she was blue in the face, she could do absolutely nothing about it. Top management was completely safe. New, young, cheap hires who would do anything were coming in. It was the middle ranks, the professional, clever book people, who were simply no longer required. "So I feel that a library meeting and anticipating the needs of its readers is absolutely my top priority," went on Nina, feeling as she did so the sense of her words going into space, of simply tumbling unheard from her mouth. She had a ridiculous, nervous urge to say something utterly absurd, just to see if they kept nodding or not.
"Yes,"
said a different, humourless-looking woman with a trouser suit and very pink lipstick, leaning forward.
"But what about anticipating the needs of your non-readers?"
"I'm sorry," said Nina, not sure she'd understood. "What do you mean?"
"Well, you're trying to satisfy the needs of all your consumer base, yes?"
Yes,
said Nina, conscious that she was on unsteady ground.
"So what do you propose for the non-readers?"
"Well, we have children's story time 2x a week. I'd love to make that 3 times. It's so nice for the mums to have a place to get together and chat. And I know our children's literature section back to front, so I've always got something to recommend to those who are a bit more reluctant. There are loads more terrific books coming along for boys, who we all know are a little hard to persuade. Plus we have adult literacy classes at the town hall, and we're always directing people there.
If you can improve literacy, you're doing the best thing you can. No, no, you're not hearing me. What do you propose for the non-readers? Not the people who can't read. Your adult clientele who simply don't like to read. Nina paused. She could hear the heavy traffic going round the roundabout outside. A rubbish truck was reversing with a loud beeping sound. There was a huge crash as it emptied one of the bottle recycling bins from round the back of the library. She said finally, blushing furiously under the gaze of the four interviewers, one of whom, Kathy Neeson, of course, was already checking her phone for the name of the next person. I could recommend them a really good book. The pink lipstick lady looked disappointed rather than angry. I don't think you're seeing what we're getting at all. Nina couldn't disagree. She absolutely didn't.
You should have talked about interfaces, hissed Griffin, as they hid round the corner sipping their consolatory frappuccinos, a justifiable extravagance under the circumstances.
Outside, it was raining, a heavy, joyless spring shower that rendered the city colourless and made the cars splash and thunder through the streets, catching passers-by with sprays of water. People were looking furious, their brows as heavy as the low clouds above. Birmingham was not at its loveliest. The coffee shop was absolutely heaving with shopping bags and damp coats and buggies, and people wearing big earphones and glowering at other people trying to share their table or getting in their way, and young kids sharing muffins and sniggering and slagging each other off. She and Griffin were sitting at a crumb-strewn table next to the toilets, beside a lawyer and his client deep in the throes of discussing her imminent divorce. It was hard not to listen in, but Nina felt she had enough problems of her own right now.
"What kind of interfaces?"
she said. The interview had not gone much further after that question.
"It doesn't matter. Computer or peer-to-peer or integrated confluence," hissed Griffin. "They really don't care as long as you use a buzzword that they can tick off on their sheet. And if they tick it enough, then it's like bingo and you win your old job back, except at a reduced salary."
He took a suck of his frappuccino and looked glum.
"God, I should just tell them all to piss off, illiterate paper pushers."
"Why don't you?"
said Nina suddenly, interested. People had given her enough advice, she might as well pass it on.
"You're smart. You've got a degree. You're not tied down. You could do anything. You could travel the world, write a novel, go teach English in China, hang out on a surf beach in California. I mean, you're not old, you're not married. The world's your oyster. Why not tell them to stuff it if you hate it all so much?"
"I still might do all of those things," said Griffin sullenly. "I won't be stuck here forever. Anyway, you're the one off on wild goose chases to look at crazy buses. I'd say you're closer to it than I am."
Nina had known he'd been secretly pleased when she'd come back from Scotland empty-handed. She'd resented the implication of that, that he was worried that if she could get away, pathetic as she was, what did it say about him?
"I know," she sighed. "It was a ridiculous dream." She looked around. "I just don't know. I mean, after that..."
She shivered, remembering Kathy Neeson's smile, which hadn't reached her eyes as she'd stood up to leave. Before the end of the allocated interview time, but after the entire thing had clearly come to a close. Nina hadn't slept well since she'd returned from Scotland. The atmosphere had been muggy and grey, pressing down on her relentlessly. Things she'd once liked, the buzz, the city noise, now made her feel like she didn't have enough space to catch her breath. She'd read lots of books about people finding new lives, which hadn't helped her mood either, had made her feel more and more trapped and stuck where she was, as if everyone except her was managing to get away and do interesting things. She'd trawled the job websites, but it seemed there was no place for librarians anymore. Information officers, yes, play advisors and local council PRs and marketing consultants, but nothing that seemed to have anything to do with what she'd done her entire life, the only job she wanted, finding the right book for the right person. She found herself missing the fresh air, the long views, the clear sunlight bouncing off yellow fields, lush green rolling hills, and the sparkling, dancing, beguiling North Sea. It felt very odd that somewhere she'd spent such a small amount of time, and which had ended up so badly, had had such a profound effect on her. She stared at her coffee again. A large woman barged past her, almost clubbing her in the face with her gigantic, expensive, directional handbag.
"I don't know," Nina said again.
"Oh, I'm sure you'll have got the job," said Griffin, incredibly insincerely.
Nina realized for the first time that he'd cut off his ponytail. Her phone rang. They both looked at each other and froze.
"They'll be calling the successful people first," said Griffin immediately. "Well done. It'll definitely be you. Congratulations. Maybe they wanted a way back to the old-fashioned style all along."
"I don't recognize the number," said Nina, looking at the phone as though it was a live snake. "But it's not Birmingham."
"No, it won't be," said Griffin. "It'll be centralized in some Swindon office or something."
Nina picked up the phone and carefully pressed the green button.
"Nina Redmond?"
The line was crackly and unclear, and at first it was hard to hear anything in the noisy coffee shop.
"Hello? Hello?"
"Aye, hello there," came the voice. "Is that Nina?"
"Yes, it's me."
"Aye, listen, it's Alistair McRae."
The name meant nothing to Nina, but the Scottish accent was familiar. Her brow furrowed.
"Hello?"
"Aye, the landlord, you know, of the Rob Roy."
Nina couldn't help smiling.
"Hello? Did I leave something behind? You can keep the book."
She hadn't had the heart to take it away in the end.
"Oh, it was brilliant, that book. Edwin passed it on to me when he was done with it."
"I'm glad to hear it."
"Then I passed it on to Woolley."
"Oh."
"Aye, well, he was in, looking glum."
"Well, books are for everyone,"
said Nina, trying to be charitable.
"Anyway, listen, me and the lads were thinking."
It took Nina a moment to realize that by the lads, he meant the two old duffers who sat by the bar.
"Oh, yes."
"Listen, that Woolley, he doesn't know what he's talking about. He's had a sad life, you know."
"Well, I'm having one right now," Nina found herself thinking, quite shocked that the thought had flickered across her mind.
"Mm-hmm,"
she said.
"Well, we reckon, the three of us, we can buy it off him, then sell it on to you, you know, if you like."
There was a pause. Nina didn't know what to say. It was so unexpected.
"Not to make a profit, like. I mean, I reckon we'd probably get it cheaper off him than you would. Just to get him to change his mind about selling it to a lass."
"Well, that's..."
Nina was still speechless.
"We just thought you looked like a lassie who needed a hand. And we really liked that book you left us. I mean, we'd quite like more books."
Nina had told Alistair the plan, and he had not stopped badgering her since.
"And that van is an eyesore in the village. And he was wrong not to sell it to you when you wanted it."
This was clearly a long speech for the landlord, who sounded embarrassed. Nina rushed in to reassure him.
"Are you sure? That would be really..."
"I mean, only if you haven't found another one you like."
"I haven't, no. I haven't found another one."
Nina looked up. The rain was belting against the windows of the coffee shop now. Every time the door opened, the wind howled in. The place was absolutely packed. A huge, noisy queue at the counter. Children crying, people looking cross and getting in each other's way. She looked at Griffin, who was checking his phone. Suddenly, he jumped up, full of delight, and punched the air. Nina blinked.
"Listen, Alistair, that's so kind of you. I'll need to think about it. Can I call you back?"
"Aye, of course."
He told her the price he thought he could get the van for, which was way below what she'd expected, and she put the phone down.
"I got it," said Griffin, his face pink with emotion. "Yay!"
Gradually, he lowered his arms, looking at Nina.
I mean, he stuttered, I mean, I'm sorry. I mean, they've probably made a mistake. You'd have been masses better."
Nina glanced down at her phone. A new email was blinking. She didn't even have to open it. "I regret to inform you," was the first line that came across in the preview screen. "Well done," she said to Griffin, almost entirely meaning it.
"I've got to head up a dynamic, young, multifunctional team," read Griffin excitedly. "Of course, it will probably be absolutely awful. I'm really sorry," he said as he saw her face.
"It's okay," said Nina. "Really. Someone had to get it. I'm glad it was you. I would have been hopeless heading up a multi-whatever."
"Yeah," said Griffin. "You would have hated it. I'm sure I'll hate it too."
His fingers moved furiously, and Nina realized he had already put it up on Facebook. She could hear the like button starting to ping.
"Listen, I better go," she said quietly.
"No, don't," said Griffin. "Come on, please. I'll buy you a drink somewhere."
"No, thanks," said Nina. "Honestly, I'm all right. I'm fine."
Griffin glanced down at his phone again.
"Come on. A bunch of my mates are just around the corner. Join us for a pint. We'll plan your next move. I must know someone who can help."
He was more energized than Nina had seen him in months. She desperately wanted a cup of tea and a quiet sit-down to think things over.
"Really, I have to get back," she said. "Well done again, though."
He stood up as she put her coat on and moved to leave. She gave him a half-smile as they stood waiting for a parade of buggies to squeeze past them.
"Nina," said Griffin,
suddenly emboldened as she finally moved forward. She turned.
"Yes?"
"Now we're not working together. Now we're no longer colleagues and I broke up with my girlfriend. Will you come for a drink with me? You know, just a drink. Please?"
She looked at his pale, anxious face and felt suddenly awkward and slightly more determined. For just a second she hovered, thinking. Then she decided.
"I'm sorry," she said. I have to call a man about a thing."
She walked past the buggies and the shopping bags and the steamed-up windows and the school children throwing things at one another and the crumpled bags of sugar and discarded plates and greasy cups, and she pushed open the door and walked into the wet street. Then, pulling up her hood, she pulled out her phone, knowing that if she didn't do it now, she never would.
"Alistair," she said as he picked up, "thank you for your incredibly kind offer. Yes, please."
Chapter 7. Even Sarinda's enthusiasm for the plan had started to evaporate now that Nina had called around the authorities and been told that to get a license to sell from the van would be difficult, bordering on impossible. Apparently, it would be much easier if she just wanted to flog burgers and cups of tea and dodgy hot dogs. She had pointed out to the man at the council that surely it would be much easier to accidentally kill a member of the public with a dodgy burger than with a book, and he had replied with no little snippiness in his voice that she obviously hadn't read Das Kapital. She had to admit that she hadn't, and they didn't get much further than that. But still, here she was on the coach again, armed with the Lark Rise to Candleford trilogy, as well as the entire Outlander series to sink into on the journey. It turned cooler the further north they went, but it was still clear, that astonishing eastern light making Edinburgh glimmer like Moscow as they passed through. The Great Bridge felt once more like an astonishing gateway into the unknown. Then, further north and north again, the cities and towns and traffic and people falling away, leaving long, lazy red trains swaying alongside the twisting roads, tiny villages, endless birds soaring through valleys, and sheep everywhere in the lush green grass, under the long rays of the late setting sun. She ate cherry bakewells from the service station as she lost herself in the pages of her book, and when she finally alighted at Kirinfief, she felt like she was coming home. Something absolutely reinforced by Edwin and Alistair's smiling faces when she pushed open the door of the pub.
"The book girl,"
they said, pleased, and Alistair poured her half a lager without waiting for her order. He must have noticed her struggling with the local beer last time.
"What have you brought us?"
Nina had, of course, come well prepared, and unzipped her case to bring out a selection of thrillers and crime novels, which the men fell upon happily.
"So," said Edwin finally. "You're really going to fill this truck full of books?"
Alistair was happily rootling around for the keys to the van. Nina had handed over the cheque that, when cashed, would represent, more or less, her entire redundancy payment.
"That's the idea."
It hadn't been too bad going to work now that she had a plan. She had a few weeks' notice to work out, but nobody was going to care very much if she took long lunches or came in late, or carted home trunkfuls of books every night, which she was doing. She felt as though she was rescuing orphans from destruction. Griffin had started wearing a shirt and tie. The beard was gone, too. He came in early and spent a lot of time in meetings, and was beginning to wear a harassed expression instead of his bored and annoyed one. One night he stopped her and said she needed a requisition form for all the books she was taking, and she'd said, "Seriously?" And he'd looked pained, and Nina had been happier than ever that she was going.
"Oh, it's going to be great," said Edwin. "You'll have to go down to Kearney Village, and over to Bonnie Banks and Windy Gates. My sister lives there. They used to have a library bus, but, of course, that shut down. So you'll be better than nothing. You can't run it as a library."
"Afraid not," said Nina. "I have to eat." She turned to face them. "You do know I'm not keeping the van here. I'm driving it back to Birmingham."
The men's faces looked confused.
"But it's for here," said Edwin. "That's why we bought it."
"No, I'm taking it down south," explained Nina patiently. "That's where I live."
"But they don't need books down south in a city," said Alistair. "They're falling over themselves for bookshops and libraries and universities and all the rest of it. They've got as much as they need. It's us that needs them."
"Yes, but I live down there," repeated Nina. "It's my home. I have to go back."
There was a silence.
"You could make a home up here," said Alistair. "Could do with some new blood around the place."
"I couldn't move here," said Nina. "I've never lived in the country."
"Yes, but you've never run a book bus either," said Edwin with stubborn logic. "Oh, I thought we were helping you out so that you could stay around," said Alistair. "I've told all my regulars."
"I thought Edwin and Hugh were all your regulars," said Nina.
"Aye, well, shows what you know. Everyone was delighted."
"I'd love to," said Nina, "but truly, I can't. I have to get back and set up and start earning a living."
There was a silence in the bar. Nina felt terrible for having misled them. She genuinely hadn't meant to.
"But," said Edwin. "I'm sorry," said Nina firmly.
Her plan was to pick up the van and drive back to Birmingham that night. She couldn't really afford to stay, even somewhere as cheap and cheerful as the pub. Plus, Sarinda had been very clear that if she didn't find a home for the books without delay, either the floor was going to collapse, or Nina was. So that was that organised.
"I have to go," she said sadly.
They all looked at the keys lying on the bar.
"It was very kind what you did for me," she said again. "Thank you."
The two men grunted and turned away. Outside, it had finally got dark, the final rays of pink fading away over the western hills. As soon as the sun went, it turned instantly cold, and Nina shivered as she stepped towards the van. She pulled her coat around her and looked up at it, huge now in the quiet little cobbled square. She took a deep breath. She couldn't remember feeling lonelier. Still, this was what she had to do. She was committed now. She was going to find a way. She glanced down at her phone. She had obviously managed to pick up some kind of a signal whilst she was in the pub, and her email had come through. At the top was one from the district council. "Dear Ms. Redmond, we wish to inform you that your application for a parking permit class 2B, vending and trading, non-catering, has been turned down due to height restrictions in the area. There is no appeal to this decision." Nina swore, loudly. There was more in an official vein, but she couldn't read it through her tears. It seemed that whatever she did, she couldn't get a break. The one thing she had never thought there would be a problem with was parking the van outside her house. Now, looking at it in the rapidly fading light of day, she realized how enormous it was. It would block out the light from the downstairs windows, and their neighbors, too. What had she been thinking? She'd spent all her redundancy money. She couldn't imagine for a second going back to the men in the pub and saying she'd changed her mind. She was out of a job, and she knew she hadn't prepared as well as she might have done for the interview because she'd been so distracted thinking about other possibilities. And now she'd failed at the most basic, obvious hurdle. She'd have to move. Somewhere she could park the van. She'd have to tell Sarinda. But what if she couldn't afford to move? Who'd let her rent a property without a job? Oh, my God, she'd end up living in the van. Her tears dripped down, and she felt very panicky. She glanced around. Nobody there, of course. The village was completely deserted and very cold. Nina felt completely and utterly alone. She tried to think of what Nancy Drew would do, or Elizabeth Bennet, or Moll Flanders, but none of them seemed quite prepared for such a moment. No heroine she could think of had ever found herself crouching beside a gigantic, unsailable van in the middle of nowhere, not knowing where she was going to live, shivering in the bitter cold. She straightened up carefully and painfully. Her hands were shaking. She simply didn't know where to go. She tried to think of places where she could park the van and wondered if she'd be safe there or whether she could just abandon it. In the absence of a better idea, she got into the cab and turned the key. There are plenty of warnings about driving when you are tired, and Nina was normally a careful driver who paid attention to all of them. Normally. But now, shocked and worried to the core, and driving a huge vehicle she wasn't used to, she felt very frightened indeed. She knew she should come off the road, but where? She couldn't afford to waste money on a hotel, even if she knew where there was one up here in this wilderness. She didn't have sat-nav, and her phone wasn't getting a signal, and in any case was running out of charge. She put her headlights on full beam and carried on along endless country roads, none of which seemed to be taking her anywhere useful. She had fuel in the tank, which for now seemed to be enough, as she wiped the tears from her cheeks with her right hand and tried not to panic. She'd find somewhere. She'd find somewhere. She spotted the lights of the level crossing ahead, but drove on. The barriers weren't coming down yet, so she'd have plenty of time to get through. She didn't see the deer until it was too late. It was hopping and bouncing away from the red lights and ran straight into her path. She saw the huge black eyes flash in front of her face, startled, beautiful and terrified, and without even thinking, she slammed on the brakes. The van skidded and juddered to an immediate halt on the crossing at a sideways angle to the road. The deer jumped away from the vehicle, its hooves tapping on the side, then vanished into the trees, unscathed. As Nina caught her breath, she heard the dinging of a bell and looked up, horrified, to see the barrier coming down across the road in front of her. Unable to think straight, she turned the key in the ignition, panicking, forgetting to put her foot on the clutch, unable to understand why she couldn't start the engine. The lights of the train were clearly visible, looming closer and closer and stronger and stronger. She knew she should get out, but somehow, although she tried, the door seemed to be locked. She scrabbled around with the ignition, trying to start the van again, and again she failed. The radio wouldn't stop playing, her hands wouldn't work. Her fight-or-flight instinct had let her down completely. She stared at the train again as a great screeching noise filled the air, and was struck by the oddest, most ridiculous thought. How embarrassed her mother would be having to tell people that her university-educated daughter had done something as stupid as getting herself trapped on a level crossing and killed by a train. By a train. Her mouth slowly opened in what she realized was a scream, and as the ground shook and the train thundered and shrieked towards her, she closed her eyes and awaited the awful inevitable. Chapter 8. There was a dark and deathly silence. The radio had somehow turned itself off. She didn't know how. The lights had gone out too. Nina blinked. Was this the afterlife? She hadn't felt anything. No impact. No pain. Maybe this was it. And it was all over. The blackness was all-encompassing.